Writers Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm your host, David Wilk, and I'm talking to Johannes Gibbsrud. Did I pronounce it correctly?
Yeah, perfect.
Not bad?
Not bad.
Who is the author of several really interesting books. One is called The Sentimentalist. That's the first book of yours I knew about. But then the newest book called Quartet for the End of Time. I thought we could talk about that.
Yeah.
And maybe also talk about your poetry.
Mm-hmm.
So we're in your office in Tucson, Arizona, where you're teaching. But you're from Canada.
Yep.
Nova Scotia.
Nova Scotia. Uh-huh.
And you've been here in Tucson for about 4 or 5 years?
Yep, about 4.5 years. Yeah.
And so how does it feel being transplanted and being a Canadian in America, being a northern person in the far southwest?
I like it. I like the contrast. And I also feel really lucky because I am able to go home in the summertime, which is really the perfect time to go home.
Right. Oh, you have the ideal.
Yes. Yeah.
Back and forth.
Yeah.
Winter in Arizona, summer in Nova Scotia.
Yeah. So I like, being able to return and know that I can do that. But there's something about this landscape that is I find really alluring, and I think that part of that is that it is so foreign to where I grew up, but also maybe a little familiar too. I mean, we were just talking about, here we are on the bottom of the ocean,
right.
The ancient ocean, and there's something about, I guess, the inhospitability and the sort of openness of the desert that reminds me of the ocean.
Well, because Nova Scotia is not... it's not as hospitable as many places. You have a lot of wind. You're surrounded by water.
Right out there, yeah.
And the vegetation does not grow very high comparatively.
Right? In some parts, yeah. And where we spend the summer now in Cape Breton is pretty rugged, coastline. And, you get a lot of water, a lot of inhospitable winds.
Right, but you have the other kind of inhospitality.
Yeah.
It's dry. Mm-hmm. It almost never rains in there.
Yeah.
It's wet all the time.
Yeah. Yeah, so I like contrast, and I like Tucson. I like being here. So,
do you think that being here will influence the way you think about writing and the way you write, or the subjects that you write about?
Certainly. I definitely find, now I always work about, seems like 4 or 5, maybe more years behind.
Writing about experience that's 4 or 5 years earlier, taking time to process.
Yeah, and I'll take notes, and I just constantly, like most writers, sort of like sketching down ideas that will hopefully turn into something or possibly turn into something someday. And so I am now, constantly being inspired by this landscape. And I think a lot of things, and this is interesting too, in terms of history, in terms of border regions, in terms of, the north as well.
Right.
Being here.
Do you think the border of water and land in Nova Scotia is somehow equivalent in some way to the border of maybe U.S. and Mexico?
Oh, I haven't thought of it that way, but that's an interest. Yeah, that. Yeah, certainly. Yeah, there's a lot of. There's a lot of. I've been thinking about borders, and that is one of them that I do think about. I guess, going back to to the inhospitable. There's. A lot of ways this metaphor that you're just drawing on, between the land and the water can be thought about in terms of the border politics, I think, here, which is just, I think there's a lot that we don't talk about remains unknown for most of, society, and that, I think continues or increasingly is coming up in conversation, is going to become, increasingly important to talk about, like, where do we draw borders?
Right.
And what are responsibilities to them and to to people who live in this part of the world. And so I don't know, I've been thinking a lot about that, and, you know, obviously hearing a lot of people's stories about the really complex politics around in this area. So that'll, you know, it'll influence me, certainly, everything does, yeah.
So that kind of is a good lead-in, in a way, to talking about Quartet for the End of Time, because that book is about conflict between, and you've mentioned in writing about it, I think, that, you know, the book is about the bonus march, principally, in Washington, D.C. It's a, you know, a period of history that a lot of Americans know nothing about, where veterans of World War I, in the face of the Depression, having nothing, wanted to get the bonus that had been promised to them earlier than it was going to be, than it was supposed to be due, because they were so desperate.
Yeah.
And out of this desperation, a kind of ragtag army of American former service people ended up in in Washington, D.C., camping out. And of course, you know, it's what happens as part of the story, so we won't go into that, but the historical fact of what happened is known. And, you know, it turns out that General MacArthur leads the army, the active army, in breaking up the bonus march, essentially, and, you know, kind of getting rid of them
because by force,
don't want to deal with it. So you have the army fighting, essentially, the former army guys, you know, the veterans from 15 years earlier. And it's a pretty fraught period, and it has a lot of layers to it, I think. And, you know, that's what the book is really about, those layers, I think. And, so in a way, that's kind of reminiscent of what you were just talking about, you know, in terms of borders.
Yeah.
The relation between people and the unknown, who maybe are simply the same, different, I have a different perspective, but what you don't understand.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I was really drawn to this. I mean, partially you touched on exactly why, in the fact that it is a chapter of history that isn't so much known. So similarly, like, I'm interested in history. I'm interested in those aspects of history that make our current reality, right? Because I'm, you know, ultimately interested in our contemporary reality, I think, but how that gets formed by what has occurred in the past, but so often sort of gets forgotten or sort of absorbed into our moment in such a way that we don't understand it as formative, or recognize it. Yeah. So when I heard, you know, when I came across the story of the bonus march, and then realized, you know, like all of these key figures in our history, and aspects of it that we do remember, you know, were also a part in this really, you know, ugly chapter in history, which, you know, when I was talking to other people, like, I grew up in Canadian school system, and so I thought, okay, well, there might be many, many holes in you know, my American history, but talking to a lot of Americans, you know, it is a chapter that don't remember, don't know, have not learned about the bonus march. And so, you know, and particularly when I came across a story around 2008, you know, when we were talking about the housing crisis, and all of a sudden we're sort of struck by, once again, you know, the sort of imaginary quality of value, right? It was like hit over the heads with it. And and so the bonus was really interesting to me in that, you know, capacity as well, because the problem with it was that it wasn't a bonus, it was an insurance policy. And but because of the language that was used and the rhetoric that was being employed, and, you know, the sort of dream logic, you know, that was being employed and was being tapped into with all these veterans, the, you know, promise that they were given, they believed the bonus was, you know, an actual a thing. It was a real thing. It was an entity, you know, but it wasn't. It didn't exist. It was, so at the time, of course, you know, in the 30s, when they were demanding instant cash payout of what they believed was theirs, it was you know, a projection, a pure projection.
Right. It was like Social Security in a sense.
Yes.
That if you're 45 years old, Social Security comes when you're 66.
Yes. Yeah.
It's a promise.
You can't just call it in.
Right.
Yeah.
Although there are insurance policies with cash value that you can call in, and that's what I think they ended up likening it to.
Right. Okay.
A whole term, a whole life policy, which after 30 years is fully paid, then you can get your money. It's like it's like a savings account.
Yeah.
Well, if you've paid in for 15 years, you don't get half.
Yeah.
But you've put in part of the money.
Yeah.
And I think that's what
Ended up happening was they did. They after many years they were awarded the bonus, but it was obviously
at a discounted rate.
Yeah. Yeah. So this that whole chapter of history, which is extremely interesting, I think, because because it was such a dark period, but I think reveals a lot of the sort of structures of our ideologies and
assumptions that remain. One of the only times in at least in American history where a truly radical political moment occurred.
Yeah.
There have been a couple, because for the most part America has been so middle class and accepting of the current structure of things for the last 100 or 150 years, these moments where there were really powerful currents of radical thinking.
Yeah, and in multiple directions. Yeah. Because you had the two sort of leaders who sort of battled it out within the bonus march was a communist leader and a fascist leader, essentially, Walter Waters, who had a tremendous popular support, but, very openly supported Mussolini and modeled himself after Mussolini. And that was happening, right here, in this country, leading up to the Second World War, was this sort of, the pitting of, communists versus, fascist ideals.
Just as was going on in Europe, only on a maybe on a smaller, less, certainly not like the Spanish Civil War, but yeah, you're right. The tendencies of populist fascism and populist communism were definitely both available, which is maybe potentially true right now.
Right, yeah, or at every moment. Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. Well, now there's another part of this novel, and of course, I'm very careful. We don't want to talk too much about it, but I think, I will say, I think your writing is extremely beautiful and kind of dreamy in so many places, even as, you're involved, your characters are involved in daily events. But the other interesting thing is that you modeled the structure of the book on Messiaen's quartet, also named
The Quartet for the End of the World,
which I wrote down because it was in French, Quatuor pour la fin du temps.
Yeah.
And I had not known about it. I knew about the bonus march, but I didn't know the story.
Okay.
Messiaen. That was really interesting. How did you find that? How did you learn about it?
Yeah. So those are the two real, threads. It's the bonus march on the one hand, and then the story of the creation for the Quartet for the End of Time, which I stumbled upon around the same time. So this is when the sort of, the origins of the book are for me, around 2007, 2008. I just happened upon it was a noontime classical music series that I just happened upon one noontime.
You mean hearing the music?
Hearing the music, wandering in, there was a performance of the Quartet for the End of Time, which is an absolutely incredible piece of music, and the little notes, concert notes, told me the brief outline of the story of its creation, which was that Messiaen had composed it, or at least finished the composition, while he was imprisoned in Stalag 8A, a German prison camp.
A prisoner of war camp.
Because
he had been
in the French army.
Which lost instantly to the Germans. So this was in
1940 to 1941, yeah.
Right.
And he was imprisoned there and did receive, you know, some special treatment. He was a famous composer already by then, and was given leave, you know, from his chores, from daily duties, and protected to a certain degree, given the materials that he would need, including, of course, the instruments for his fellow musicians. Right.
Which was a quartet.
Which is a quartet.
Him playing
piano
as well.
Yeah, uh-huh. So he, there's so many interesting parts of the story. So, I mean, part of the thing that fascinated me was that, you know, what the quartet is bound by to a certain extent is the circumstances that, you know, he was imprisoned with. You know, it's a slightly unusual pairing of instruments. We've got the violin, the cello, the piano, and the clarinet. And, you know, because he had found himself with these three other musicians who played those instruments, they finally, you know, managed to find the instruments. And the stories that are told afterwards, too, is interesting to me that, you know, the legend then became that, and I think, like, Messiaen talked about how, you know, there was the piano, several of the notes didn't function on the piano, and, you know, there was all these things wrong with the instruments, and yet they still managed to pull this off. So this idea, and then later on, you know, other accounts were like, no, that wasn't true, you know?
Right.
The piano was a functioning piano.
Like romanticized.
Right. Yeah, but the way that, you know, I'm just so interested about the way that, you know, these sort of material or concrete aspects of our reality really come to embody, you know, symbolically, of course,
right.
You know, or the reality that is, you know, fabricated to a certain degree, and then it's not. It's also a way of, you know, gesturing toward this reality that you know was existent for Messiaen. It was a tremendous struggle, of course, to write, to complete the composition and to have it performed. But at the same time, and far more than that, what intrigued me about the story is the controversy that surrounded even at the time and then afterwards, especially when, you know, in 1941, Messiaen was released and returned to Paris and took up a post at the Sorbonne, which, you know, had been vacated previously, made available for him because the previous, you know, employee was no longer in France, but had been deported, was the sort of role or the responsibility, of the artist, and where, you know, that commitment to the art, blended into politics. And so that's something I take up in the book a lot, is this question of whether or not we can conceive of a separation between art and politics. And Messiaen, and, you know, I give his voice is influenced by, you know, it's fictionalized certainly, but is influenced by some readings that I did about his reaction and his philosophy. And he said, no, you know, there's absolutely no blend, that art is, you know, a separate sphere and needs to be, you know, protected as such. And then, you know, there's voices of dissent, of course, that argue that there's absolutely no way.
But that tension is definitely an ongoing argument between artists, always, and between artists who otherwise agree with each other.
Yeah,
often,
yeah.
Because the art, you know, it can so often exist in both realms.
Right. Yeah, and on the level, certainly, you know, of responsibility within, you know, like a grounded social historical moment, but then also, you know, even in the abstract sense of, you know, what, you know, going back to that idea of like, well, what is the truth of that moment? Do I convey it most accurately? Am I most honest or most responsible to the truth of that historical moment by presenting the facts? Or, you know, or am I more faithful to the reality by, you know, employing some fictional elements as well?
And many people will argue that fiction is the truth. It's just, it's not obliged to reconcile with fact. And in that way, that's where maybe the beauty comes from.
Right. That difficult relationship.
Yeah. Well, I thought I really liked the book, and I was interested also in the notion of structure.
Hmm.
And recently I was talking to the writer Ursula Le Guin about her poetry. And in her most recent poetry, she's been working in form.
Hmm.
And she wrote an essay about the way that form enabled her to be creative in a different way.
Hmm.
And I was thinking about that, and, you know, because you created a form for the book,
yeah,
based on the quartet.
Quartet.
So it is in, I think it's in 8 pieces.
Yes.
Is that,
mm-hmm.
Right? So,
yeah.
And how did you feel as you did that, that the creating of the structure enabled the rhythm of the writing in,
yeah,
a certain way?
That was my ambition, to be constrained, to try to be faithful to Messiaen's quartet, whatever that might mean, because even as I took on the project, I knew that it was, to a certain extent, an impossible task, because as I was listening to the piece of music, which is, you know, so beautiful, but it's a lot of its beauty. I mean, Messiaen was really interested in dissonance as much as he was in harmony. So, you know, there's that relationship.
Did you try to replicate? Not literally. Mm-hmm. I don't,
yeah,
mean that you would have to follow,
yeah,
the music in,
yeah,
the writing, but did,
yeah,
you try to engage some of those elements to?
Definitely.
To,
yeah, that was my great ambition. And, you know, because as I was listening to the piece, and then certainly also thinking about the background and the story of the piece's creation and all of these, you know, paradoxes that we've just been talking about, that I thought, you know, if I could write, you know, you get these sort of flashes of inspiration. I think that it isn't about the object. I think that you might, or even, you know, it's just that impulse of thinking, oh, this is the thing, you know, if I could do this, you know, but then what does that mean? You have to puzzle that out. You have to struggle with you know, the material that you have, but yeah, that was my flash of ambition, was that I wanted to translate the complexity of that piece of music, mm-hmm, into words,
right?
And so yeah, so I did want to be constrained to a certain extent by that form, to be as faithful as I could, and the, you know, maybe the you know, one example of that that's probably the most concrete is the interlude, where we, in my book, what I've done is I've included images that interrupt the text, because I started thinking, you know, well, what is an interlude? What is an interlude? And what is an interlude within language? And, you know, in Messiaen's piece, he doesn't go outside of music. So in a way, I'm being unfaithful to the structure by going outside of my material, my language.
You could argue that you're saying that you could have done the interlude in language.
In language, uh-huh.
But
I decided to use images, but I think I had in my mind of like, okay, well, how does one do an interlude within language? I thought, you know, John Dos Passos, his camera,
yeah,
I know, that was in my mind. I thought, no, I don't want to go that route. I wanted, you know, despite how, you know, technically maybe I shouldn't have, I wanted to get outside language. I thought that was an invitation to get outside language. And then I thought that the images are a way of doing that, while at the same time exploring language. And this was the way that I came to rationalize it or think about it, to a way of exploring language more minutely, sort of accessing the fundament of language, which is, you know, it is image, right? Imagination, the world, you know, the representation, right? And which we, you know, often and most sort of immediately encounter as a visual image. So I decided to go that route. And so that was one, you know, one example of the way that I tried to, you know, both be as literal or as I could about the structure, while at the same time using it as a sort of, you know, creative jumping off piece. But I love that you brought up the Gwyn, who is just, an amazing hero, right? And she, I often quote in my classes, it's from her National Book Award speech, where she says, writers of a larger reality. And that's basically what I, you know, was trying to get at, you know, when talking about this line between fact and fiction, or being faithful.
Memory and representation.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. Well, and also, like her, I hadn't thought of this until just now, but you write in all, you write fiction, you write short stories, novels, poetry. She does not draw a, you know, a kind of artificial distinction. It's writing.
Yeah.
And it's whatever takes up the, you know, it's like the tool, whatever tool fits the moment.
Yeah, and that's, I would totally agree. I feel, that they're, that the line between genres is extremely fluid, and it does,
But not all, but not so many writers feel that they cannot take on the difficulties of other, you know, some fiction writers don't write poetry. Some many, many poets would say, I can't write fiction, or it's just beyond me.
So
it is, I don't think it's not unusual,
doesn't not exist,
but it's not, it's not as common to find a writer like you who is able to write well in multiple genres.
Well, I think you're right. Like how you're saying that Idris, or maybe via Le Guin, saying that, you know, that just offers you a different, offers you a different angle. I think of it sometimes as like, you know, again, thinking of the image as being a way of examining language, or, you know, an element of language. I think, you know, poetry is so often, it can be, you know, a way of just looking at things under a microscope, you know,
and the compression enables you to see things that are not possible to see on the, let's say, the larger canvas. You know, that's a bad metaphor, but you know, a novel is a much broader, you do things differently in a novel. With compressed language, you will focus. And I read a few of your poems, and I thought they were, you actually were, your lines were longer than I thought. You know, when I was reading them, I, as I read them, I read them as shorter lines, but you had them spread across the page. It was really interesting.
Okay, yeah, so were you reading published poems, poems from published collections, or new poems?
Yeah, it was, I think the poem is, was, that I read was called A Kiss Is So Soon Forgotten.
Oh, okay, yeah.
And it was really just interesting how you, the line length was so long.
Isn't, I've been thinking about line breaks, and that it is, oh, actually, I was, what I've been, was thinking about particularly was a quote from Muriel Rukeyser, who's one of my, you know, another hero, and she talks about, she says punctuation is biological. I also think about that in terms of, you know, line break, you know, but you can use that. I like that she talks about punctuation, because you can take that in both poetry and in, you know, narrative fiction, but that, you know, bringing it back to the, again, you know, thinking about, we haven't talked about it in quartet rhythm, but that's, you know, so important to me in thinking about that book in particular, but also in thinking about writing in general, and just like how connected writing language is to the body, you know, in so many ways. And so, so yeah, I feel that that is a really important element. Also, like time, I mean, maybe that goes back to the body too. And, but thinking about line breaks, thinking about poetry, I think of it in terms of, you know, just pacing. And with poems, and this is, I think, what I try to do in prose as well, is find a way to sort of slow down, slow the pace of the language, and that's also like the thought, and sort of stay with images and stay with thoughts, instead of sort of, you know, feel like we're taught increasingly, you know, and especially when we were talking too about you know, moving from the page to the screen, to skim, to read so quickly.
And it's hard to slow the mind. The mind is always constantly dancing, and you know, it's like meditation.
And you're looking for the, oh, what does this relate to? Oh, how does this, you know,
instead
rather than
experiencing,
being, exactly.
Well, you know, you were talking about the body and poetry. And I was thinking about Charles Olson and the notion of the line is the expression of breath,
mm-hmm.
you know, and that it's simply a, it is a physical thing. And it also relates in a way back to Nova Scotia because mm-hmm. he lived in Gloucester,
yeah.
right on the ocean. And uh-huh. he thought of the, you know, he was seeing the ocean in one direction and the land in the other direction,
mm-hmm.
you know, the human being, the physical being yeah. in these giant places.
Yeah.
Anyway,
yeah.
But I always have been struck by his notion of breath.
Yeah.
That breath is the definition of line.
Yes. Yeah. I like that. And I like that. Again, the idea of the ocean and the land and, yeah.
Right, well, the tension
imagining is too. And that's a fluctuating and it's, you know, it's,
yeah.
You know, outside of our human, you know,
right.
sphere, but it is still all, you know, this idea of what we, of drawing the line. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Where place mm-hmm. is defined
yeah.
and
mm-hmm.
human beings have to figure out how they.
Yeah. How they fit in. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. How they can image or, yeah, relate to that, which absolutely, yeah, includes but exceeds them. Yeah.
Right. Which is, mm-hmm. I mean, there is a tension
mm-hmm.
of scale
mm-hmm.
that's
absolutely.
Related to time,
yeah.
too.
Yes.
I mean, I think, you know, you were right to bring up time. I
yeah.
think that was really, you know, that is the definition of humanity,
mm-hmm,
really.
Mm-hmm.
That's all we
right.
have.
Yeah. And I think, you know, that goes back to the story of, you know, Messiaen and, you know, I have him, there's a, he sort of shows up, he has a cameo basically in this book, but the story of the creation is told. And, you know, at the end, when he you know, performs the quartet, he says, you know, it's a quartet designed, it's written for eternity, but in the current moment, because for now, that's all we have, you know, so always this tension between, you know, the present moment and the desire to go past that, to write past that, to, you know, and, you know, I think two of his, you know, his moment of inspiration, which he claimed was when he was a 10-year-old boy, and he looked at the reflection of light on the Saint-Chapelle Cathedral stained glass, and he thought, I'm a musician. But this idea, you know, first of all, the synesthetic, you know, moment of the colors and the light and, you know, sort of this sensory overload in a way. But then also this idea of, you know, what he articulated, he was also deeply religious of, you know, this ambition, this desire to access, you know, outside of his own moment, his own 10-year-old moment, you know, something that was so far beyond and inexpressible, something he couldn't really even put his finger on, but he said, I want to do that, you know. So I think that, yeah, it comes back to that, a lot of you know, that tension.
Well,
between
that's and so clearly
mm-hmm.
in a way what you've just described is the risk
mm-hmm.
that
mm-hmm.
an artist, a writer takes
yeah.
by making that ambitious leap
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
and saying, I have to do this.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's very beautiful.
Mm.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, thank you, Johannes Gibbsrud, for talking to me. This is David Wilk for Writer's Cast. I've had the great pleasure of talking to Johannes Gibbsrud about her work, and most recently, Quartet for the End of Time. Thank you so much.
Thank you.